afternoon. So last time we kind of finished up our kind of brief discussion of x86-64 encoding. As I mentioned, kind of the two primary things I wanted to get out is I wanted you to be able to do the encoding by hand with references if you needed to do that, though most of the time we'll just have an assembler do it for us, and to talk about this issue of relative versus absolute addressing, which there was a quiz question about, as I mentioned, and we definitely need to talk about that based on how people did. So, let's go to talking about that quiz question. So we had four snippets of assembly, and the quiz question asked, could we basically move this code somewhere else and have it do the same thing, you know, when it was jumped to, and have the same machine code? So we have like two issues, like does the machine code for this code depend on where it is, and does it do the same thing no matter where it is? So in this first snippet, we have this compare, and we have this value, which is relative to the instruction pointer, meaning it's relative to the start of this address, sort of this instruction, this JLE instruction that immediately follows the compare. And it turns out that that is the opcode of the map, is what that's actually reading. So if we can take that whole assembly snippet and move it around, that's always referring to the same thing in memory, even though it's relative to the instruction pointer. And otherwise, what this code does, we have to, otherwise we need to worry about other relative encoding. This JLE is encoded using sort of the offset to quax and this star RAX that doesn't depend on any addresses, so it's not going to change depending where you put the code. So the machine code for this doesn't change, and the only things it references are values in registers or that byte from one of the instructions. So it in fact is going to work the same way no matter where we put the resulting machine code, and the resulting machine code is going to be the same no matter where it is in the thing we're assembling. Questions about A snippet. For B, we have this reference to malloc present RIP, and this is going to be the sort of offset from the LEA to malloc. And since malloc isn't part of this code snippet, that's going to vary depending where we put this, so the machine code is not constant the way that this is encoded. So then we have C here. So C, we do a call of foo, and you might be concerned, oh, how are we encoding the address of foo? With call instructions, it's relative. So it's just the offset from the call instruction to foo, which happens to be zero in this case. And then we pop RAX and use RAX and then clear RAX. So what is RAX? Well, RAX is what is the value pushed by call, which is going to be the same thing equal to the return address of the call. And what's the return address of the call? Well, it turns out that this whole snippet here, this is just a funny way of doing move foo, so I guess, sorry, LEA foo foo into RAX, and it's one that gets encoded the same way no matter what. And then this access here, this is accessing the opcode of the pop instruction, therefore, and copying that to BL. And then we XOR EAX, so the resulting value in EAX doesn't depend where this code is, even though we temporarily stored the address where the code was. And that's why I cleared EAX. Right, this example. And finally, we have our third example here. We load this constant into RAX, and then we use LEA to do some math on RDI and RSI, putting the result in RDI. And then we jump to address 10000, which is not, doesn't seem to be in this assembly snippet. We actually jump to what that address points to, sorry. We don't double indirect jump. So that, I think, should behave the same way. And there's nothing in here which needs to be encoded differently depending where things are, because we're not referencing any sort of external symbols. We just have a constant address. That's not going to change, and it's going to be encoded as a constant in the move instruction. That's not going to be relative to our current address, because I didn't use RIP in there. It's not an LEA and something. So questions about our four pieces of assembly for Q4 and how they sort of, you know, whether they're encoded constantly and whether they behave the same no matter where you put them. Yeah?
Could you explain one more time the difference between when you encode a R0X4 versus the malloc in reference to the RIP? Why is one of them?
So, the question is, why was 0X4 RIP and malloc RIP different? So, this is, I would say, a bad design decision the GNU assembler, the standard assembler in Linux, has made, which is that this syntax, it means the means RIP means, I sorry, to say memory at RIP plus 0x1234, which is what we expect given how the parentheses usually work in AT&T syntax assembly. This syntax means memory at malloc, but encoded using malloc minus RIP. So the encoding puts malloc minus RIP in the instruction instead of the absolute address of malloc, but otherwise it's the same as if we wrote malloc. And this is basically an arbitrary choice the assembler makers made. You can argue that, you know, is this good or bad, but that's what they did and what we kind of have to live with. Does that answer your question? Other questions, follow-ups, comments? Yeah. So a question, the actual machine code for the label one is pre-computed? Yeah, so it's computed by the linker. So we know that we have object files and we have the linker go in and, you know, fill in the blanks. It fills in that blank, computing the difference, not using the absolute address. In this version, there's nothing for the linker to fill in. It just, the assembler just puts a 4 in the relative offset part of that move instruction, or sorry, compare instruction. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so that I think was definitely worth talking about, and we're going to talk a bit about viruses later today, and this becomes very relevant when we're talking about inserting code in other programs, which is something malware often tries to do, or manipulating your own code, another thing even non-virus style malware often tries to do. So then we talked a bit about some reverse engineering topics and mentioned kind of some intra-obvious first steps for, like, I have an executable or some other piece of thing that might be malware or otherwise interesting. How do I figure out what it does? Talked about, like, figure out what the file type is, figure out what libraries it uses, figure out what strings it has in it. And these are kind of in first steps, and we looked at, you know, how Dihedra was an example of a tool kind of specialized for that, though we could just do all that stuff with object dump and some light work, maybe in a more annoying way. We also mentioned this kind of difficulty with disassembly. We're kind of used to, we object dump something and it just gives us all the disassembly. But object dump is kind of having to make some guesses about where instructions actually begin to do that. And it could get fooled sometimes, and in particular, if we're thinking of a malware author who doesn't like us disassembling their malware, they'll probably arrange for it to get fooled. And we might need to deal with that. And we looked at some selected other features of tools like Ghidra. I mentioned Ghidra is one of the family. One other big thing is that they just do the consolidation of like figuring out where are all the references to this function, where are all the references to this global variable, which is really handy information to have when you're, you know, reverse engineering something that's not a little tiny program, you know, which often happens in the real world. And we kind of finished up by mentioning that Ghidra and its competitors do this sort of kind of magic thing of decompiling, that they will convert the assembly back into C. And often this might be a way you want to work with those tools. And we'll look a little more about sort of reverse engineering stuff and talk a little bit about debuggers, which of course you've used. Just want to mention some things that are possible with debuggers that you might not have thought of. And then go into how viruses work. Before I do that, questions on things we covered last time. Okay, so one piece, some anonymous feedback came up is that I gave you the answer sheet for RE1, and it uses the quiz system, which I did end up explaining that, oh, when the box turns green, your answer is submitted. I didn't do that in time as early as I should have. I didn't explicitly tie that to RE1. I'm sorry, I know that confused people. The way that answer sheet works is we have records of your submissions at every time that you like move your thing outside. I'll give some slack around the deadline, and I can restore your submission as of a certain time for like if you're worried about getting a late penalty when you shouldn't, I can do that. And I guess one other thing on the quiz. So the quiz, question 3 people had trouble with. So here there was confusion. When object dump shows you relocation entries and symbol table entries, those entries are actually stored somewhere in the executable. There's actually an array in the executable. And the elements of that array have an address. That's not the address they're showing you. They're showing you the contents of that, which points to the actual symbol or thing to be replaced, the relocation in the executable. And typically they show you the memory address of that thing, not its offset in the file, when it's at a constant memory address. Okay, so let me do some miscellaneous things about that you can do in Ghidra. So one thing worth mentioning is, I mentioned we have these cross-references. Ghidra has this view, as do most of its competitors, where you can like just examine kind of the tree of functions, because it's doing the analysis to find out what functions call up other ones, and probably mostly gets it right. Might miss some cases, as we mentioned, like disassembly has these corner cases. But this can be a way of like just figuring out at a high level, like if you see some interesting function, where does this come from? You can try to work that way. And you can see that it kind of generates these function names kind of automatically because we didn't have symbols in this executable, and you, as we mentioned, you can rename things for that. And when I finished up last time, I showed you that we had this decompiling, that Ghidra has this view where it will take a function that it's found and try to convert it back into C code. And this is probably a really nice way of working with things. And, you know, these decompilers have gotten kind of surprisingly good. You know, you can see that this is not like super clean code. You know, maybe these types aren't really the correct types and so on. Like, undefined date. Obviously, it didn't figure out what that real type is, and you might have to refine that. And as we mentioned, you can do that. Yes?
What dot stands for?
What dot?
Like DAT.
Oh, what DAT? So this here is, this is its placeholder name for a global variable. Just like fun something is a placeholder name for a function, this is a placeholder name for a global variable where it doesn't know the real name because there was no symbol. So if you want to work with just the assembly, maybe because the decompiler didn't figure it out correctly, or because you want to know what's at a lower level, traditionally, Dihedra and all the other reverse engineering tools traditionally have this kind of graph view, where you can see they have our chunks of assembly, and they kind of have these arrows pointing to the different places it can go. So this chunk here ends with a JZ, so it has an arrow to where it goes in if the JZ is taken versus not taken. So you can kind of look at these chunks, and kind of deal with the control flow that way. And this is a GUI, so you can drag those chunk things around, rearrange them. And this is kind of traditionally, especially before decompilers were any good, or when decompilers aren't good, often what sort of people are doing reverse engineering will look at to figure out what functions do. And if you're looking at not this graph view, the non-graph view in programs like Dihedra usually has these arrows on the side showing you where things reference, so you can follow that listing more straightforwardly. As I mentioned, you can refine our decompilation, so when that works. You can also make types for set the types, and including marking things as arrays. So sometimes Dihedra won't figure out something's an array. You can tell there's an array here, it's this size, and it will adjust its decompilation accordingly. Now, we're not gonna go into super detail about how the decompiler works, but we can kind of look at what's going on, that kind of underlies this. If we go and click this button here in the listing view, there's an option to enable this pcode field. And the way Dihedra works is that it converts the assembly into this simpler set of instructions, and then it compiles that simpler set of instructions into, I guess I should say, set of simpler instructions. It compiles that set of simpler instructions back into C, basically. And this is also how most of the other decompilers out there, I mentioned Binary Ninja and IDA Pro, they use a similar style, that they don't actually work directly with the assembly. They have this kind of generic format, and that's important because people doing reverse engineering, we're doing just x86, but you probably have to do in the real world ARM and a bunch of other different platforms, and you want to use the same tooling for all of that. So we can enable the view, and you can see that this is how Dihedra is working internally, is that it has kind of a translation of each instruction into these simpler operations. And that's what it's actually converting back into C code. And this form also allows some other analyses, which we won't talk about much right now, but we might get to later in the day, later in the class. So for example, Dihedra has a find similar functions tool, and probably it works on the pcode representation because the goal is that it doesn't care if it's compiled differently. It just wants to identify, this is stringlen, and tell you that. And also, we can use this form to actually emulate the code. Dihedra has a built-in emulator that can basically just interpret this pcode statements to run this, even if you can't run it natively. And there's some other tools which we'll talk about when we talk about sort of vulnerability discovery that do sort of more sophisticated analysis, taking advantage of having these simple operations representing each instruction. And one is something called symbolic execution, where basically we run these simple operations, but instead of like adding two numbers together, we say x plus y is x plus y, and then at the end we say, well, what if the answer is 10, how did that happen? And we solve for x and y. And this seems like pretty complicated, and it is, but this is a kind of practical way to automate analyses like, hey, if I reach this piece of code, what could the values of RAX be? Like, you can automatically figure that out by doing this kind of computer algebra this way. Or like, there's this piece of malicious code here, when does it get run? What does the inputs from this file have to be, for example? Often these techniques can figure that out automatically. So we'll talk about that much later when we talk about vulnerability discovery, but this is a preview of like, it's not just useful for like giving us human readable representation. This is kind of the start of automating what would otherwise be pretty tedious hand analysis of code. And potentially automating things like finding security flaws or figuring out what malware does without as much manual human intervention. Okay. And one other thing I'll mention that the Cahedra does is it has a patch instruction feature, and you can save the modified executable. This is another thing that like you traditionally wouldn't do in a debugger that is kind of useful for analyzing malware. You know, if there's a check, is the malware running in a virtual machine? This is what you might do to that. Just replace it. And the other big way that we kind of do reverse engineering of malwares is using emulator or debugger style tools, which you've done in the past. I assume most everyone here has done that in CS01, I hope. So I'm not going to like harp on much about debuggers being useful for this. You know that you can like step in the debuggers, you can look at the assembly, you can look at registers. I want to mention some other things you can do that maybe are less intuitive. So debuggers traditionally have watch points. So you can have a breakpoint, but instead of the breakpoint being triggered by going to a particular instruction, the breakpoint can be triggered by modifying a memory location or reading a memory location. You can have a breakpoint on any system call. So if you just want to know what system calls a program makes, you know, what requests of the OS it makes, you can just set a breakpoint for that. You don't have to like find all the library calls. You can search memory for strings instead of just searching the executable for strings. You can save copies of memory for analysis later. You can debug a program that has already started or that's on a different machine. And you can force a jump to a particular address or force an early return from a function in order to like figure out how something executes without going through all the context around it. Questions on my sort of selected things in debuggers you might not have known about. I think for most people, the most surprising is usually there's watch points that you can like have a breakpoint that triggers when something reads a global variable. And I'll also mention briefly that Cahedra has some debugger integration. Whether it's useful or not is complicated. The big thing that Cahedra's debugger installation integration does is that it can save what it calls a trace, where it records what things you looked at when you stopped the program. So there's a list of snapshots, and the snapshots of everything you examined while it was stopped. So you can examine memory to make sure it's in the snapshot, and then you can go back later and kind of step backwards to that prior snapshot and look at that. You know, so it kind of automates what you could do by hand of just saving the memory and analyzing it later. If you look at memory at one point, step forwards, you can step back and it will show you that memory you looked at earlier. And I have these slides, which we can refer to when you, if you actually want to use that. For the most part, things in this class, the normal debugger interface should be fine, but you might like the Cahedra one more. So with that, I'm going to get on to our primary topic for today, which is going to start talking about self-replicating malware now that we have kind of looking at how do we analyze malware and how does encoding work, because encoding is going to come up a bunch. We'll talk about self-replicate. And kind of the reason why this used to be like the most common category of malware is that, you know, a big problem malware has is getting to run somewhere. And historically, kind of the easiest way of doing that was having programs people wanted to copy around and modifying them to contain your malware. This maybe doesn't happen so much anymore, but this used to be very common. So our viruses would, you know, have a program someone already wanted to run, a program they already wanted to copy, back in especially in like the late 80s, early 90s. And viruses would typically automatically modify programs, would be the goal. You know, so you wouldn't just create like as one specially handcrafted program, you'd have something that could modify a whole bunch of different programs to insert your malware into it. And viruses used to be a big problem. This was kind of the rise of antivirus software. It's less of a problem today. There's still like the idea of producing modified versions of real software is like a common thing. If you're like trying to get pirated software, often this is a concern you would have, that your wares would be, you know, not an actual version of that program, but a version that's modified maliciously. But back in the early days of viruses, when people were commonly copying files around, viruses were such a problem that they were not infrequent to see on commercially sold legitimate pieces of software. Some company selling software would accidentally release a version with a virus in it of their own software. And there were a lot of different examples of kind of prominent places that had found viruses in sort of normal software they had on their machines. And then kind of this is what the first wave of antivirus software was for. And since this was kind of the early days of computing, we had this virus problem, and it was a kind of different problem than sort of malware these days. A lot, not all, but a lot of the early virus software was kind of a hobbyist endeavor. There wasn't an explicit trying to get money or harass people goal to it. Like, it wasn't nice, but it wasn't malicious in the way we are used to malware being today. So to give a concrete example, we're going to look at a specific virus from the 1980s called Vienna, which fortunately someone has published the actual code for, so we can look at it. And this was written for Microsoft DOS, which ran on 16-bit x86, and it modified COM format executables. So COM is not the format you're used to executables being in on Windows these days. They're EXEs. This is a very old executable format. And things were simpler back in the times of DOS and these COM format executables. So COM executables have no header, no segments, no sections. The way it works when you run them is they get copied to memory at address 0100, and then the operating system jumps there. There's no memory protection. Everything is readable, writable, and executable, which is going to come up a bunch in this code. So this was kind of our early viruses working in a much simpler environment than later. And how did Vienna infect a COM file? So here, let's say I had this uninfected file. The beginning of the file is this move instruction. I've marked this as 100. We know that's in the very first byte of the file is that move instruction. It gets loaded at address 100. And this move has an encoding of B9 to a 4F. And the way Vienna worked is that it replaced the beginning of the executable with a jump to its code, which it appended to the end. Now there's a problem here that what we're replacing is probably important, and we need to put it back. So what Vienna did is it saved a copy of the bytes it replaced at the end of the executable. And after it ran its code, it would run this code that would do a copy. This is basically a sort of mem copy to 0x100 from 0x903. So it's copying those bytes it saved later back into memory at that location. And because this is a copy of the executable in memory, but we're not modifying the original executable, we're just modifying the code in memory and then jumping back to the original location. So that's what this does here. So this is a funny way of doing jump back to the beginning, back to address 100, which we just put back that code in, the original code. Questions set up here. So one thing you might be wondering about here is that I'm telling you that we set SI here to point to 903, the place where we inserted that copy of what was originally at the beginning of the executable. And we have to like have the reference to that be correct. And the way Vienna did this is that it stored in its code a constant which was the location of its data. And of course, it's going to have to somehow figure out how to change this each time it infects a different file. Because we're appending to the end. You know, in this example, we're starting at memory address 700. Sometimes you might start at address, you know, 815 or something else. And that's going to change where our beginning of data pointer here is. And we have to edit the move instruction to do that. So you see they load that address, which we have to fix up when we infect another file. And then we add our offset. So there's some other data that's saved along with the original application code that's going to need. And then we do our mem copy of 3 bytes. And at the end, we mentioned we have this, you know, so once we finished correcting the beginning to not to have the unmodified code, we do this jump. And actually, there's a bunch of setup being done for that here. So notice that we're clearing all the registers because we want to the executable that we infected to run normally possible. And you can see we do this kind of very funny sequence to jump here, that we push 100 to the stack, then we And to do that, we need a temporary register. Then we clear that temporary register. Then we use return to jump to that address, because return pops from the stack and jumps there. Question here. So why do you think the authors of Vienna did this instead of just having a jump instruction? Like, why didn't we, you know, just instead do XOR DI DI and jump 0x100? Why is that not the code that they used? Why did they use this more complicated thing? Ideas? Yeah.
I'm thinking maybe because
jump at the end of the function is more suspicious. Okay, so you're thinking maybe this is stealthier? Okay. Yeah.
Is it to like prevent the like move out cycle? Like for the 64?
So it's to prevent alignment requirement?
Yeah.
So happily for the Vienna authors, 16-bit x86 has absolutely no alignment requirements. It allows you to put things at any address. This is indeed not always true on modern systems. Other questions? Or sorry, other options? So I'll give a hint. The likely answer has to do with encodings. So if we think about how this is encoded, this is going to be the opcode for move, move constant, plus something about DI, plus the value 100. Right? That's how it's going to be encoded. If we think about how this jump is encoded, this is going to be the opcode for jump plus the offset to 0x100, right? And that depends on where this code ends up. So this is something they probably did to make it easier to generate the code, because they can just use some constant stuff for the version on the left side, but the version on the right side, to actually generate that machine code, we need to change the bytes that correspond to the 0x100 depending on what address this ends up at. And each time we're going to need to change something, that's going to be extra work we have to do in our kind of infection code. So this sort of awkward way of doing jumps has the advantage of not needing that sort of fix up in calculation. We could do that. They could do that, but they probably just said it saved them time just to write it in this more complex way that avoids needing that adjustment. So questions about justification for that? Okay, so let's talk about kind of the steps of infection. And there's kind of three questions we can kind of think of in these virus-style programs. So one thing is that when we infect a new file, where do we get the code to infect it with? So talk about that. Like, how do we get a copy of that code to put there? What do we have to do to change that code to customize it for the program we're infecting? And we also have to worry, and most virus software have to worry, about reinfection. That if we just blindly infect every single executable file by appending to it, eventually we'll have, like, you know, our executable files will keep getting bigger and bigger, and you'll run out of space in your floppy. And that probably means, you know, you're going to break things and not be stealthy, and you don't want to do that. So let's first talk about this first issue. How do we get the code to put at the end of the executable? And a way we can think about this is, let's say instead of appending machine code, I wanted to do this for C code. I want to have a C program that adds itself to C files. And this seems kind of tricky because I'm telling you, oh, I need to make a C program that prints out kind of its own source code. And this, you know, you might see in kind of hobbyist programming communities known as being a client. And it's possible to do this in any programming language. But if you're thinking of just doing this in pure C or pure Python, it's not really intuitive. Right, because we have the issue that we can't just have the code as a string because we need to have that string contained in other code, so we need to do some pattern adjustment. You can do it. So here's an example with some extra line wrapping of how to write a client in C. So we see we have this template here, and I have percent %C and percent %S to represent placeholders, and one of the placeholders is the template itself that we're going to encode as char star P percent %S. And you see we have that string in itself, basically. So this is, you know, something we can do. I've written axi values as numbers to avoid having sort of string nesting issues. So you can do this. And you might imagine, okay, so they're writing assembly like this, except it's generating machine code with this sort of thing. But this is not what any real malware tends to do, even though you can do this, because there's a dumb solution. This is like a really lots of clever work to get this program to output its own source code. And this is what we want to do if we want to append its own source code to somewhere. There's a dumb solution. And the dumb solution is what most malware uses. Here's my dumb solution. We're just going to read it, We're not going to cleverly generate the machine code. We're just going to read our own machine code. Just like here, we can read our own C code. Yes, you could avoid this if we really needed to. But we don't need to, and it sure saves a lot of time. And this is, in fact, what Vienna does. So Vienna figures out the address of that data portion. It figures out, computes based on that, where the beginning of the virus data is. The virus code is, and just writes that to a file when it's infecting something. So it's not like doing clever code generation stuff. It's just copying its code from memory into the new executable. There's not sort of this funny coin logic, you could do that. Questions? So then there's the question of, we learned that probably some of the code needs to change depending on where it is in the binary. We saw that sometimes the Vienna authors avoided this by making it so, if we need to refer to address 100, we do that in a way where the machine code doesn't need to change. But there's some references in the code which aren't written that way. And also, we need to insert the code at the beginning of the executable to point to the actual inserted code. So the primary design that Vienna uses is that it uses the register SI to store a location of data, and it just uses offsets from this location. And this means that what Vienna does when reinfecting is that it just modifies the immediate field of this move instruction, and everything is relative to that because of how they've written the assembly. Everything is adding or subtracting from the value that stores in SI. So that's the only place to change in the code that's appended. And just before they write an infected version to a new executable, they just modify this value, which is safe to do because the code's already run. So it's modified with the value for the new executable when it's written to it. And how do they figure out where that machine code is? Well, they know it's offset from that location, so. So they know, they figure out the length of the file they're infecting. They know where it's going to be. They know where they're going to write to, and they know to modify. The other thing that Vienna needs to do is modify the jump, insert that jump instruction at the beginning. So to handle that part, in the data portion, Vienna just has a copy of a template for the jump instruction, but it's going to have the wrong address filled in. And they just modify that template to have the computed offset. And just make sure that happens before they write out the value of that template as modified to the beginning of the executable file. So this is writing to the beginning of the infected executable file. Some questions? So one thing I'd like to mention is that it's interesting to me that Vienna has this code here that it modifies carefully, because we don't actually need to do that. We saw an example on the quiz that we can find out the address of the current code, so we could have written code, Vienna could have written code that calls and pops to get the address of the current location and done an offset from there and not have anything to modify in the actual thing it appends. But for some reason, the authors decided not to do that, even though they're clearly, you know, fine with dealing with jump instructions, because they do that at the beginning. But you can't really talk to them to say why they did it, but, you know, you don't actually need to have something to modify in the code if you're careful about how you write your assembly to only use this relative addressing. You can, like, get the address through that mechanism. So another thing that actually we have to worry about, so we figured out how do we read the code? We just copy it from the existing infection. How do we adjust the code? We have these two places we need to modify. So we have one place where we just have the hard-coded location of the constant in the move instruction, and this template for a jump instruction. We fill those in before we write. And another thing we need to do is not reinfect files, so infected files don't keep getting bigger and bigger. And Vienna's solution, which a lot of other early viruses did, is that it scans for files to infect, and it marks them in the file metadata, so it can quickly figure out it's already infected them. And there's lots of choices for how we can mark the file. The particular choice Vienna made is it changed the modification time of the file. In particular, on DOS, DOS stores modification times in two 16-bit fields, one encoding the date, the other encoding the time. And the time field has a 4-bit value for the number of seconds divided by 2. So on this version of DOS, you can only store file modified 0, 2, 4, 6, and so on seconds past the hour, past the minute, rather. And that ranges from 0 to 31, multiply by 2, so from 0 to 62. And obviously, 62 and 60 like aren't really valid values. So Vienna just set the time to 62. And it needed to update this anyways. It wanted to change the modification time anyways to hide its tracks. So, you know, this wasn't really extra work. So that's my exploration of Vienna as an example. So next time we'll look at some other things that malware has done and could done, some different decisions you can make than Vienna for our self-replicating style malware. And then after we look at that, we'll think about detection options that, you know, knowing this behavior is going to let us do.